Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mishna Wolf is white, but her dad, also Caucasian, strongly encouraged her to be black. In the urban Seattle neighborhood where they lived when she was a child, Mishna has been good enough to share the story with the rest of us in her memoir, I'm Down. It's out in paperback now, and she's with us now to talk about the book and her life. Welcome to the show, Mishna.
Good morning.
Your dad identified as a black man. You know, when I was reading about the book, before I started reading the book, I thought, what? How do you do this? And more importantly, how do you write about it? When you sat down to write your memoir, were you thinking, this is what I'm going to be writing about?
Well, let's see. I didn't, like, sit down to write my memoir like, I'm so old and I've had this amazing life in the White House, so I'm going to sit down and write my memoir. It was more like I was doing these storytelling series in Los Angeles and New York, and you know, I would tell all these different stories because, you know, I was in comedy and stuff like that, and nobody really locked on to anything the way they locked on to my family stories. So people would come up to me and they'd start talking about their family.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of was like, well, there's something unusual about my family, because I didn't necessarily know up until that point that we weren't the most normal family in the world.
So does that explain why you didn't rebel more? I mean, you were typical, you know, don't do what your dad asks you to do kind of a thing, but you never really articulated much.
I mean, I definitely, it was funny. It's like, I think that this is true of a lot of kids of sort of my generation that had, you know, that were rebelling against their parents. They had more sort of hippie values, or things were a little bit fast and loose. You just sort of like always are kind of trying to create the structure rather than trying to break it down.
Right. Your dad identified as a black man. Can you give us the backstory on that?
Well, my dad had moved down to Seattle from Canada when he was about 12 years old. And he moved into this neighborhood that, I guess when his parents had bought the house, his dad came before him because he had gotten a job for Boeing. So when his dad, when they sort of moved to the neighborhood, when they bought the house, it was, you know, primarily, you know, it was, you know, Asian and also African-American, but also white. And as, you know, as the white flight started to happen, people gradually moved out of this neighborhood and into the suburbs. And, you know, by the time my dad was in high school, he found that, you know, most of the people around him were African-American. And he went to the local high school, which was, you know, also at that point very African-American. And he played sports, and most of the people on his sports teams were African-American. So by the time, you know, and he sort of went to the East Coast and met my mom and had me, and then came back to this neighborhood. And by the time I was born, you know, it was just everyone was black, and he was like a black guy.
He wanted to be black.
Yeah, he absolutely did. I mean, he always says when he came to the U.S., he had wool pants or something, and it made him not really fit in. I think, you know, in life you sort of go where it's warm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was definitely an athlete, and, you know, the people that, you know, most saw him as excellent were other athletes that he worked with, so he was, you know, on teams with. So, you know, when I was growing up, you know, everyone around him still remembered what a great athlete he was, and I think that was important to him.
My guest is Mishna Wolf, author, humorist, author, her paperback's out, or the paperback version of I'm Down. Mishna Wolf's memoir is out now, and that's what we're talking about. If you have a question or comment, like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and go for it there. The premise seemed preposterous. Like I told you, I was trying to wrap my head around it, unless you live it, of course. And then I read the memoir. Did the message that came out of the memoir make sense immediately to you, or did it come about through the writing of it?
Well, you know, I wasn't going to try and write a message, because I think when you try and write a message, I mean, to me at least, when I'm seeing a movie that has a message, mm-hmm. or a book that has a message that's intended to be a message, it's always it's always didactic, and it always, you know, it always sort of like you feel preached at, mm-hmm. I think, a lot. Well, I was just set out. I wanted to share my experience. I wanted to do it in a way that other people, even if they hadn't had the experience, could relate to it because, you know, I think a lot of people have had the feeling in their life of being a fish out of water, being a misfit, feeling like an outsider, maybe even in their own family, mm-hmm. Like I did. So I really just sort of wanted to, you know, I think that when you write a memoir, there's sort of a sounding call. I mean, I've realized this since I've written one. And that's sort of like, hey, is there anyone else out there? And you just sort of see if anyone comes back. And I think that you sit down on at your computer and you feel like you're the only one in the world and you sort of feel alone, but you're like, okay, I'm going to write this letter anyway and just see if anyone responds.
Stick it in a bottle and throw it out to sea.
Kind of, yeah. There's definitely that feeling with memoir.
But you're also very funny. And it's very, very funny. And I love how it's told from the point of view of a child, a child who ages during the book, of course, and you know, has different experiences along the line because of the changing age. But just that kind of just spitting it out. You're not trying to analyze it or anything. You're just spitting out what you were living.
Yeah. And, you know, it's because at that time in my life, I didn't know that I wasn't allowed to think certain things. I didn't know that I wasn't allowed to say certain things. I didn't know that I wasn't, you know, that I didn't realize that all these taboos existed yet. So I think, and, you know, and it's like, I sort of felt in a weird way, like, I think a lot of people in memoirs, they annotate from their adult selves or they use their adult voice to talk about something.
Yeah.
And I just sort of wanted to get in it and look at things from where I was sitting, because what happens when you get older, at least, and part of what precipitated the memoir, and for people who don't know, the memoir is, you know, it's there's a lot of race issues in there, mm-hmm. a lot of black and white race issues. And what happens when you get older is you start to look at some of your preconceived notions about things or why you think of things a certain way, and you're like, where did I get that from? Like, that's crazy. And so part of this memoir was going back and looking at those places, like, where did I get this crazy idea from that, you know, that, for example, like, that rich people wore torn jeans and poor people like us ironed their shirt, you know? I don't know why, like, I had all these, like, ideas, like, you know, I don't know, like, you know, especially around, you know, what how to act rich and how to act poor and just what, you know.
Well, you know, there's another element to the story that it wasn't just about growing up in this neighborhood, but you tested, you're like, you know, you're a brainiac or something. You test into this school that gives you a scholarship, I guess. Was that it?
Yeah. It was an experimental program.
Gotcha.
for the highly gifted. It was like, there were like 25, you know, upper middle class white kids with pretty pushy parents. And then me, who was, you know, I mean, we were so far below the poverty level, it was ridiculous. And I came from this like very tough neighborhood where, you know, I don't know if it was so much tough as it was like, it was a whole different set of values mm-hmm. that I was operating with. You know, it was like, you would just be the fastest, the strongest, the, you know, quickest, the funniest. And there was no thought of like couching anyone's feelings or interact, you know, it was just like the best one always.
But you were sort of like the Michael Keaton, as you mentioned earlier, you were trying to create some structure out of your life, and you saw right away that even though the school was tough at first, that it could get you places.
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, it was like anything. It's like I come there, and everyone's got these boats and ponies. And when I first meet them, I resent them for mm-hmm. having boats and ponies. But then after a while, I'm like, oh, I could hang out on their boats and ponies. And I think for a kid, that really, like, it computes. It's like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, this is better. But I also like recognized at some point that these kids were not going to end up some of the ways that I saw people in my neighborhood ending up, and they had bigger and better places to go to. And, you know, I wanted in on that.
I think the saddest parts of the story for me, of course, there is sadness, and it was about the rich kids.
Yeah. I mean, when I first started to interact with, I mean, it sounds strange, but when I first started to interact with middle class white people, it was at a time where I didn't have any problems that a check couldn't solve. You know, a check could solve pretty much every problem I had in my life. And not only that, most of the people around me, like $10 could, you know, really do a lot. Mm-hmm. But I started to interact with people with more complicated problems. And that's not to say that people in my neighborhood didn't have complicated problems, but I wasn't seeing them for mm-hmm. whatever reason. There seemed to be enough of everything else, at least in my immediate vicinity. And I started to see kids with much more complicated problems and stuff that I didn't even begin to understand. And I think it really threw my perceptions of things on their head because, you know, all my looking over the fence at the, mm-hmm. the other yard, you know, sort of, you know, it just, I just realized I didn't really know what it was like for anyone else. And
that's an important thing to learn. You know, I guess I really started to like your dad once you started to introduce these loser dads from the upper middle class.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, people sometimes harp on my dad a lot in this memoir because, he didn't make life always easier for me. Sometimes he made life really a lot harder, but he was around a lot, you know, and he was involved a lot, even if he was totally, you know, misguided and, you know, at his own times, he just didn't know, and he was a little bit megalomaniac, and you know, trust me, we had our issues.
I trust you totally.
Yeah, you've read the book.
I read the book.
For those of you that haven't read the book, trust me, it's jam-packed with issues.
What? We have to take a break in a second, but could you explain the deal with your mom and dad and why your dad ended up getting, I don't know how, most of the custody of you and your younger sister?
Yeah, he had the majority custody.
Yeah, majority, yeah.
It wasn't that uneven, but she was working full time and she had, you know, this really kind of steady job, and he had been sort of underemployed, and so it just made sense to them. And she had weird shifts too. Like, I think she had a graveyard shift and, you know, a couple really strange shifts. So it just made sense to them that my dad would have us on the weekdays and we'd see her on the weekends. And then plus, you know, there was he had a little bit more legal help. Anyways, he really, really wanted us, mm-hmm. you know, is basically the long and the short of it. And, you know, they sort of agreed to, you know, make him the primary custody parent.
Okay, we're going to take a break. My guest is Mishna Wolf. She's author, humorist. Her book, I'm Down, the memoir, is out in paperback right now, and that's what we're talking about. So you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go, you can Twitter us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, and let's see what else. Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen online at WOSU.org. And WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's When Did Tax Become a Four-Letter Word? Featuring Dr. Jason Seligman. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org. 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a beautiful day with a high of 85. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 85. And looking ahead to Wednesday, more sunshine and a high of 87. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Mishna Wolf, author of I'm Down. It's a memoir of her life growing up in a poor black neighborhood with her single father. Mishna, the cover of the book is you at what age?
Yeah, I'm 8 years old in that photo.
Okay, now, I'm one of the – I cannot tell a lie. There were a few days that passed, and I actually thought you actually had that fro.
Huge white afro?
Huge white afro. I mean, the biggest afro I've ever seen. And finally someone said, are you nuts? I mean, of course that – and I don't know. You know, I'm going to be one of those people that's completely, you know, taken in by Photoshop down the road. But it is a Photoshop, but it's still hilarious. Well, you know, it's as you, I think you told someone, provocative. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely provocative. I'm, you know, I'm white as the day is long, and it's with a huge, you know, afro superimposed onto it, and, you know, yeah, I mean, it's provocative. It's I mean, I sort of got the cue for it from, there was a Norman Mailer essay called The White Negro that came out, oh, I don't know, I think, I couldn't tell you, actually, early 50s, maybe? I'm not sure exactly, but there's a... It sort of shows a black and white. Their technology at the time was like, there was like a white person in a black negative. So it's like they just used the negative from it. And I thought it was kind of, the image always stuck out in my mind for whatever reason. So,
but you did have cornrows. You talk about that.
Yes, I had a million African-American hairstyles, if you can call them that. I mean, I had cornrows. I had 4 to 6 ponytails at any given time. I had... I had a perm. I permed my hair at one point. Would put, you know, I just did everything to look more African American.
Was that to get your dad's approval or just to fit in general?
I think it was just to not get my butt kicked. I mean, I really felt like if I could soften my approach. I mean, I was very high contrast in the situation I was in. I felt if I could just buffer my approach a little bit. Just give people a moment to say, is she maybe before, you know, it was just like, you're white.
Now, if your dad could have managed it, would he have wanted you to look that way? Is that what he wanted, do you think?
My dad wanted me to be popular.
Yeah.
And he thought that that was the most important thing in the world. You know, that was definitely something that was, you know, that he strived towards always, you know. And more specifically, he wanted me to be popular in a way that reflected well on him. So, you know, he had this community. He had this group of people he was popular with, like any other, you know, like any suburban coffee clutch, you know. He wanted me to, you know, sort of get along with people and, you know, make him proud.
And you were just kind of naturally shy, right?
I was naturally awkward. I was self-conscious.
Okay.
I definitely wasn't the most outgoing personality in the world, and my sister really, really was. Like, she was like a star. Wherever she went, she was like singing and dancing and entertaining people, and she was cute, and she had curls, and, you know.
And they totally loved her automatically.
Always. She walked into a room. She just was, you know, if I look back on it now, she just was not one of those people who's just not afraid to be themselves. Always. And I was just a little bit more trepidatious about, you know, everything. So, you know.
So she might not, if you didn't write the memoir, she definitely wouldn't have written it. She's lived life differently than you.
She'd write a different memoir. I mean, I think at this point, you know, I mean, she would write a memoir. It would be a different memoir, I'm sure. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying she's dying to write a memoir or anything like that. But, you know, if it was her perspective, I think it would be. She still has some of the same issues and stuff that I do, you know, just because of where we grew up and how we grew up. I mean, it's strange to be, I mean, I guess it's just once we were exposed to, you know, sort of white people and that whole, you know, that whole world, it became more strange to us how we grew up.
I was reading an online post after an interview you did in June. I think it was with Tony Cox. I can't remember. And the person who posted the comment was angry. That you remarked that growing up you were intimidated by black women and black girls. And she wanted someone else on the show at the same time, a black woman who could respond with her own story of alienation by white women. which was, you know, I got what she was getting at, but do you get that angry response very often?
Usually, if I get an angry response to the book, and I've gotten a handful, I wouldn't say more than a handful.
Okay.
I get them from people who haven't actually read the book.
Yeah, she had not read the book.
I get them from people who've looked at the cover, maybe read the back of the book, maybe someone who just opened up to a page and there was something funny in it. Because, you know, humor and race don't always go very well together unless they're really, really well balanced. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I wrote this book, I went out of my way to show the complete picture. So, I mean, I wrote people that maybe on page 30 don't seem very complicated, but by page, you know, 175 are a little bit more balanced and a little bit more well-rounded. And, you know, no one really comes out smelling perfect, including myself.
One of my favorite parts, although I liked lots of parts, because I just learned so much from the book. I don't know. It was funny, and I just enjoyed it. But it was the Value Village.
Oh, thank you. No one's ever said that before.
The store. I used to go to Yankee – what was it called? I can't remember the name of the store now. But there was a crappy store that I used to go to where I could really make $2 go a long way when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And Value Village was that for you. Tell us about Value Village.
Value Village was it was a store in the Rainier Valley – in Seattle, where I grew up, that it was just like you could always get something. Like it was a thrift store, but it was like it was a cheap thrift store. Like even for a thrift store, it was really cheap. Like not all thrift stores are affordable, but this was like unbelievably. I mean, you could get your shop on. Let's just put it that way. And my dad, like I remember for school clothes or whatever, he dropped me and my sister off there with $20, you know, for the two of us. And it would just be like, okay, get your September wardrobe. And it was a gas. Like, it was really, really fun. Like, we'd have a really, really good time in there just going through all the racks and picking out old clothes. And, you know, every now and then you'd be like, ooh, Nordstrom brand. And you this one. And it was just the best, best time.
It's where you went to get your ski clothes.
Yeah, it's where I went to get my ski clothes. And, you know, I had this older black lady, you know, trying to help me pick out a ski outfit based on what we thought a skier might wear. All of us, none of us. It was me and a girl from the neighborhood, Zwina, and my sister, and this older black woman trying to figure out what skiers look like based on all these racks of used clothes.
You ended up being a very, well, an excellent athlete. That was a big deal to your dad. He must have been thrilled about it.
Yeah, he was really thrilled. Yeah, and in hindsight, I'm pretty happy that I did all the sports that I did. I mean, at the time, it really was a drag to me. I mean, if you read the book, it was just like, oh, man, another attempt to fit me into that box. You know, because I felt very heady. I didn't feel particularly athletic, but.
But you were.
I was, you know, I was. I actually was. And it gave me a reprieve for my head, I think sports does that for a lot of people, but.
Your dad injects himself into your sports a lot. It's a real big deal for him. You know, definitely living vicariously. No, nothing unusual about that. But I thought it was really sweet when you're going to swim across, when you're in the swim club and you're going to swim across the lake, or I can't remember, was it a channel or a lake or what it was. And your dad decides he's going to go with you.
Yeah, 2.7-mile swim. I'm on a swim team. We're you know, 11 to 19 years old. We're in the best shape and a person could possibly be in their entire life. And my dad's like, oh, I'm gonna come along. Like, the arrogance of it at the time was
right.
Just like, you're going to swim 2.7 miles with people in peak physical condition who do this 5 hours a day. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah.
Didn't it make you mad?
It made me furious. But, you know, he did stuff like that where he would just look, he had this like, I don't know, he had this little bit of magic too, you know, where he could just every now and then do something that was so unexpected and so amazing that, you know, it was hard to fully dismiss him as just smoke and mirrors and bravado.
Your sister didn't think twice about it, but you were terrified for him. She was on the swim team at the same time, and she was like, oh, forget about it.
Yeah, I was, because I, you know, it's like I sometimes because I knew him, and I knew, you know, he'd kill himself to prove his point. You know, I really thought he was willing to drown in order to just make this point.
That was what? What was his point?
His point was, I'm here. You can't ditch me. I'm your dad. Yeah.
What does your dad think about the book?
My dad's the biggest fan of the book. I know that's hard to believe, but he's actually, I mean, he's you know, he's embraced it. We've had, you know, some strife in our relationship since the book was written, and, you know, we're in a really good page now of our relationship together. So he sort of has embraced and accepted the fact that, you know, I needed to, you know, put it all down in print. I think he thought it was helpful for me. And at this point, he's just, you know, he'd like us to be close. And
part of the pain he caused you were in the relationship he chose for himself.
Yes.
Tell us about some of those. There's actually some of the joy he caused you is because of those relationships, too.
That, too. Absolutely. And that's why I think that that comment of about black women in the book is a little bit misguided. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the most wonderful characters in the book are black women. I mean, characters, people in my life growing up, you know, were these black women. And, you know, some of them were had some issues with me, or I had issues with them, but ultimately they were complicated people with, you know, a lot going on, and they were very strong women. The first one was named Dominique, and Dominique didn't like kids. And she would point that out all the time. So whatever she was doing, she'd be like, and you know, I don't like kids. It would be like, you know, it would be like, you know, don't eat my cake because I don't like kids and kids eat cake. And, you know, it'd be like, don't sit on the couch because you're kids and I don't like kids on my couch. It was just like, it's like at some point we're like, we get it. Yeah. You don't.
Was she the young one or?
She no, the young one was Yvonne.
Yvonne.
Yvonne. And Yvonne was really young. She was 23 when her and my dad started their relationship, and he was in his 30s. And she was actually at the time closer to my age than to his age. So it was a little, you know, it put us in a position which at the time I see was a rival position. But back then I didn't understand because I still felt so much like a child, you know, and I didn't quite get what was going on with her and the sort of insecurities that were going on in their relationship. And so, you know, I was internalizing a lot of stuff that was just really just, you know, their stuff.
Yeah. And he, you know, I guess that was a point in the book when I kind of, your dad kind of ticked me off the most.
Yeah. Yeah. I think most people. And it sometimes people will say, oh, that woman was evil or whatever. And it's like, you know, there are three perspectives in the book and they're all right. And that's what makes it funny. And that's what makes it dramatic. But it's like, we all had a point of view and all three of us had a point. If you really look at it. And I think my dad had the shortest leg to stand on, but you know, here's this woman, she's 23 years old. She's working to support this whole family of like five of us, you know? Mm-hmm. And at the time, at the time when I was like not getting what I wanted and really trying to make a leap out of this family into my next, you know, endeavor, which I was hoping was like a great college and a pretty robust career as an anesthesiologist.
Right.
That was my hope at the time.
Big bucks.
And I just looked up doctors and I found like, what's the highest paid doctor?
Exactly.
I was like, that's what I'm going to be, an anesthesiologist.
See, I did the opposite. I decided to be a journalist.
Yeah, I hear you.
So, yeah, so she thought you were kind of high and mighty.
She thought I was kind of high and mighty. And she was, what I didn't realize at the time was, you know, it was like, she was supporting me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she was supporting me and she was supporting my dad and she was supporting my sister. And, you know, she was really busting her ass and working to make a break sort of out of our milieu. In her own way, too. And my desire, I mean, I was kind of, in her mind, hogging the resources.
She also, it was an interesting dynamic that she wanted to get you kind of prettified and kind of get you moving on with your life. And part of that meant helping you become a young woman more quickly.
Yes. I mean, And that was really interesting. I think she sort of saw this. I think there were a couple things going on. I think she was she sort of saw the looming sexual power on the horizon and wanted to, you know, put the reins in my hand, you know, before puberty was upon me, full fledged. But I also think it was a sort of way to divide me from my dad, and it was ultimately very successful. Is that, you know, he was relating to me a lot as a child still, and, you know, I think she wanted some of that care. You know, I think that in her mind, you know, she had seen in my dad this sort of older caretaker, you know, and someone who would really take care of her emotions because, you know, my dad was very romantic and he was very good at sort of, you know, talking to women and making them feel like he's going to understand and care for them like no one else will. And, you know, I could just tell from the way women acted around him. I mean, he was crazy good with women. I mean, crazy good. So for her, I think she really was just trying to, you know, inform him, you know, she's a woman now. This is a hands-off moment. This is where you let go. Mm-hmm. And so she was just trying to make a woman out of me.
Your mom, how much did she figure? And you moved in with your mom then when you were 14 or 15?
About 14 years old. Mm-hmm. She figured in tremendously where the book leaves off, yeah. I think. The thing about this memoir is it's like a snapshot of my family in a time of, like, real flux where no one knew what to do. And, you know, and at the time, I mean, the thing about it is when I was growing up, I thought they had all the answers and everything was very well choreographed and there was an end game in mind and, you know, all these things. It never would have occurred to me that they were just flying by the seat of their pants.
And if it had?
I don't know. I think I might have actually really become Alex P. Keaton. I don't know.
All right, we got to take another break, and then we'll return with Mishna Wolf, author, humorist, author of I'm Down, a memoir. It's out in paperback right now, and that's what we're talking about. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. I'll just throw that phone number out there for you. Maybe you can remember that. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Neuroscientist Susan Berry was cross-eyed since infancy, unable to see in three dimensions.
The snow would appear to fall in one flat sheet. I did not feel like I was part of the snowfall, but I was looking in on the snowfall.
After intensive training, she sees differently.
All of the snowflakes produce this beautiful three-dimensional dance.
Berry's book is called Fixing My Gaze. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Tuesday night at 9 on WOSU TV, celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Boy Scouts of America by watching this warm, tender, and funny family documentary called 759, The Boy Scout Troop of Harlem. Follow 11-year-old Keith Dozer, the troop's newest scout, as he and other troop members go from the streets of Harlem to a camp in upstate New York to learn valuable life lessons and skills that only come through scouting. Watch 759, The Boy Scout Troop of Harlem, Tuesday night at 9 on WOSU TV. And it's 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40, sunshine today and a high of 85, clear skies tonight, a low of 60, sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 85. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Mishna Wolf, author of I'm Down, a memoir. Mishna, your mama phase of your life.
The capping.
Yeah, tell us about that. The capping,
well,
right.
Well, we had, after my parents got divorced, my dad got a job during the day, and we were spending weekdays with him. So we went to this community center, sort of boys and girls club type sort of day camp. And there was like nothing to do. There were no toys when we got there. There was almost no adult supervision. So what the kids would do all day, and by the way, me and my sister were the only white kids there. There were no other whites. And what the kids would do all day is bust on each other, and it became this game where they would just like go around and make their rounds, and if they saw a low-hanging fruit, they'd just come in and pluck it. And I had never, ever even imagined any place could be so cruel and harsh. But I learned to really respect the good cappers, and they called it capping at the time, which I guess in some places they call it the dozens, in other places they call it busting. I think I've heard a couple other terminologies for it, but there it was called capping.
And so what would they do?
They'd just be like, you know, your mom is so buck-toothed she can eat corn on the cob through a fence. Or they'd come up to you and, you're so ugly, you know, the cat saw you in the sandbox and tried to bury you. They get more elaborate. A lot of people would talk about my butt a lot because my butt was about the flattest thing anyone had ever seen. I must have been like Christopher Columbus in the world, because it was flat, flat, flat. And it was always like, the thing they would say is that my butt looked like two saltine crackers that done lost their box. That was always it.
So they would get elaborate, though. You became a master.
I wouldn't say I became a master. I got to tell you, now, and you know, it's like, at the time, I thought I was capping on a
you
Jedi
You learned to
level.
Cope, yeah, okay.
Yeah, but it's not the most original sort of form of insult. A lot of them are really recycled. And, you know, by the end of the summer, you're like, I'm going to take half of this cap and mix it with half of this cap. And everything's like stuff you heard around. There's a lot of repeated caps. It's not like, once you get to the trick of it, which is like you just steal other people's bits a lot of time. And anything you hear around, you just sort of take it. You know, there were a few that I invented myself. But, you know, I, for the most part, you know, it's a pretty unoriginal form of joke writing.
It's a survival mode. But did you find yourself enjoying being, I guess, in that way funny?
Yeah, I mean, I just enjoyed feeling a part of. I mean, the first time I got a high five for busting on somebody or, like, really, you know, taking someone down, I definitely felt fantastic. I mean, I had finally arrived. I, like, belonged with black people at that point, and that was, you know, it was astounding to me. And it also meant I didn't really have to be afraid. And I don't know why, but at that point, the best defense seemed like a good offense. So somehow having a smart aleck remark to say about someone, you know, pretty early on in our relationship, you know, or soon after meeting someone. I mean, I'm talking about kids my age. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't bust on adults because that really, really gets you into trouble. But it just was like I just didn't need to be walking around intimidated anymore, it felt like.
And then you changed schools.
And then I changed schools, and the rules completely changed on me. The kids did not get capping, and they did not cap each other.
The teachers didn't get it either.
Teachers did not get it. I mean, the teachers in my old school just pretty much thought I was a retard and took every – and, I mean, I don't mean to use that word out of turn. They actually used the word retard and took every opportunity to tell me how – stupid I was and how it was not going anywhere and what a big loser I was. And then I get to this new school and the teacher's like these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, you know, excited about teaching women who are like, you can work at your own pace. Let me know if this is too challenging for you. Let me know if you're not being challenged enough. You know, you can pick out the materials you'd like to work on next. And I'm just like, who are these women? They're like pod people.
You stayed, though. You wanted to leave. But you stayed.
I wanted to leave. I wanted to leave everything I did initially. I wanted to leave the day camp. You know, I wanted to leave the school, but I had to stay in Deal. I mean, there was no other choice. My mom thought it was like really my only shot sort of academically. And, you know, it's nice to go from being called a retard to feeling like you're, you know, smart. I mean, feels really good.
But you weren't necessarily academically prepared for that school.
Not at all. Not at all. Because it took a lot of, like, book learning. And I didn't know how to learn. I mean, that's the one thing you mm-hmm. don't get when you grow up in a neighborhood like mine. It's very poor and not very, you know, academia is not necessarily a major I mean, I'm not saying there weren't academic kids in my neighborhood and families, but, you know, not that I knew. What you don't get is you don't know how to budget your time. You don't know how to discipline yourself to learn. You don't know how to, you know, learn how to learn. And there was just so no structure in my house for that sort of thing, you know. It wasn't like my dad was going to take my, you know, long-term report that was due in 6 months and help me budget my time on it.
In fact, he was disruptive sometimes. He dragged you over to that friend's house, or was it a new girlfriend's house or something, and you had some work to do.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in hindsight, I think he wanted some attention, you know. He didn't like it when I was in my book.
Yeah, I think that was another time when he ticked me off. Because it was so, in some way, so unlike my own, you know, upbringing.
Yeah, it ticks parents off a lot, you know. I think it ticks a lot of people off a lot. But, you know, I think by the end of the book, you know, there's sort of a well-rounded story of a relationship that, you know, does function. It did function. And even though it was maybe not the best place to grow up, you know, the dealing really turned me into someone who can deal.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Mishna Wolf. She is the author of her memoir, I'm Down. It's a national bestseller. It's out in paperback now. That's what we're talking about. Your sister ended up not going to the same school as you. Did you stay close with her? How did your relationship work with her?
You know, I have to say that we grew apart at some point, my sister and I, and I think it was a lot about this stuff. She sort of stayed on this sort of trajectory that she was on, and she was very ensconced in African-American culture and African-American people, and I sort of, you know, coming from the neighborhood we were, and I just didn't want to be poor anymore. I had some goals for, like, I don't know, what I thought was a better life. And, you know, I think we just sort of stopped being able to relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, we just made it important.
Mm-hmm. That you shared more than you didn't share.
Yeah, at some point you get out into the world and you look at your siblings and you're like, oh, my God, they have all my secrets.
Mm-hmm.
They know who I am. You know, they were, you know, it's also like when I left, I left on a sprint. So I sort of left my world and my life behind me, and I didn't want to be associated with, you know, how I grew up and where I grew up. And, you know, I wanted a fresh start. I went to New York. I reinvented myself, basically. And there starts to become a nag where it's like, okay, who really knows me? And you're like, you know what, my sister really kind of knows me. So
614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call. And Siobhan, you are on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As a writer, I'd like to know a little bit about the process that Mishna went through to be able to look back at some of this stuff and write about it from a humorous and objective point of view, and what her process was. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you. Mishna?
I was, you know, I was already, like, I had been a comedy writer for a long time, and I know I'm talking very sincerely in this interview, but, you know.
Please don't.
I have to say, you know, my process has always been I save it for the page.
Uh-huh.
So I've always wanted to, I've gone through my life and I wanted to say 5 million things to 5 million people who really teed me off. And what I did, you know, as a polite young lady in America, is I would sit down at my computer and put it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always where my humor sort of lied. So, but I will say that the process for me was, it was like going through your childhood again. It was not fun a lot of the times, you know. Even though the book is so buoyant and lighthearted, and everyone who reads it says it, it's like, it's really serious. It deals with all these serious issues. It's sad in some places, but it's the spirit of it is very young. It's very lighthearted. It's very funny. And what I did was I just got in my old shoes, and, you know, I came from that perspective of looking at things from a child's perspective and picking out the sort of the incongruencies of the world I was living in, and sort of blowing them up and looking at, you know, what the adults around me were doing and sort of the craziness of everything around me.
There's in one of the chapters you talk about the food at your new school and how fabulous it was and how you had to straddle this world of pretending like you didn't like it with the other girls, but then also figure out how to eat it because you were hungry.
Yeah, I was always hungry. I mean, if you read the book, it's like there's always like that's my biggest complaint is like I'm hungry. So it's like I'm hungry. We were always going through couch cushions and stuff like that to go to the corner store. It was always about getting some bologna and some white bread. But at the school I went to, there was like wonderful hot lunches. But you know, when you go to school with, you know, sort of like, and I'm not labeling any labels, but at least at my school, you know, sort of upper middle class white kids of a certain age, they are so grossed out by this school lunch. They were totally, totally grossed out by it. And I was like, this is awesome. But I had to act like it was like, they're like, ooh, it must be like cat or like that smells like my dead dog when it died or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, it's totally gross. So I need to eat half. I would always be portioning like, I can only eat half of this, and then I need to leave the rest of it. Otherwise, I'm going to be gross, too. It was always like, you know, I'll eat the salad. No, I'm not going to. I'll eat the cake and just leave, and I'll just be like, oh, I had to eat that because I was so hungry, but it was so gross, and that's all I can eat.
And secretly, you're...
Secretly, I wanted to, like, hoover the whole tray.
You know, and, you know, another thing I always keep using, the thing that ticked me off about your dad, but, you know, he didn't feed you guys well enough.
You know, he sort of thought whenever he was hungry, we were hungry. And it was like, it wasn't necessarily, we didn't necessarily have that whole meal structure in place.
Uh-huh. You talk about, you said, I lived with a single man who liked to go out. My sister and I had literally been living off a Costco container of Minute tapioca for a week.
Ah, the Minute tapioca.
Uh-huh.
Fond memories of evenings with the Minute tapioca. Yeah, we had a lot of Minute tapioca meals.
Taught you how to cook, right?
Yeah. It did teach me how to cook, though. For me. You know, you leave me a few rotting scallions and some eggs and...
614.
Right. Yeah, we have a stir fry.
292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Mishna Wolf, she's on the air for a few more minutes, so get your call in. It definitely, the book feels more serious toward the end. It's sort of coming to a cliff. And then you do. You're right. It's just a snapshot. I wanted to say, well, did she ever get to be an anesthesiologist at the end? I wanted to know, of course. And I had to remind myself that, no, you're a humorist and you're an author. And that's why you wrote the book. But how did you decide to end it?
Well, I think the end to me is when – I mean, when you're talking about a relationship that is as – fraught and weird as mine was with my father, and you know, it was weird and it was fraught, and the dynamic shifts a lot throughout the book, and it's like, you know, it's like, who's the adult here and who's the kid, and it's not quite clear. To me, the end of the book was always, you know, the moment that I felt free of it. And that was such an enormous, it took such an enormous amount of disloyalty on my part to sort of, I guess, get the confidence to say, you know, I need to become somebody, and I don't know who that is yet, and I don't know how to do it, but I can't do it here. And to me, that's the end of the story. You know, who I become and how it happens is another story.
Are you writing that?
I am.
Good. Your mom, did she stick up for you enough?
You know, my mom is a complicated person, and, mm-hmm. and definitely at that period of her life, it was really a complicated time for all of us, but I think she really could not confront,
mm-hmm.
you know, so she opted out her role in a lot of situations, and that was just her little red wagon to tow. I mean, it's like, she, I'm sure, was doing the best she could with what she had. I'm sure my dad was, too. I mean, I'm sure they thought that they were You know, there's a lot of what people would call selfishness in there, and I think a lot of that selfishness is, you know, they had a lot of fears, too. But she just could not confront, you know, and that came up over and over again for me when I needed protection from certain things.
Yeah, because you would point blank ask for help, and she's like, I think you better go back. And that did that, I don't know, I guess we're all hurt by our parents at some point, rejected, whatever.
It was wildly painful. Wildly painful because I really wanted her to step in and step up and draw some line, have her draw some lines with people for me. And I learned pretty young that she wasn't going to do that, if there were going to be lines drawn, I was going to have to draw them myself, which, you know, for an 11-year-old, it's a huge responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She did bring that counterculture hippie thing to the relationship, though, that I never had growing up, the idea of karma and just kind of the whole metaphysical experience of being a human being.
Yeah, I mean, that was a time for her of a lot of experimenting, and she brought a lot of new ideas into our life. I remember any time I would be messing with my sister or vice versa, and we'd then bump our head or hit ourselves. She would always say, instant karma. And I just remember, I guess all parents don't do that.
No.
And she was funny. I mean, she was a really sarcastic person, and it was always kind of funny.
She was sarcastic, huh?
She was. She was really sarcastic.
And I don't get that. I look forward to the next chapters.
Yeah, maybe there'll be more in there. But yeah, she was inadvertently humorous all the time.
Oh, you're in New York. Do you perform anywhere? Do you stand up? What do you do?
I used to do a lot of stand up comedy, and that's sort of how I came into the comedy scene. These days I do more, you know, essay writing. So okay. I'll write pieces for some shows. And I'm actually in Los Angeles at this moment of life. I seem to pop back and forth between the two every couple of years.
But, and you have a website, too.
I do have a website, yeah. It's missionofwolf.com.
Right. We'll post that on our website at WOSU.org. I didn't bring up the front porch. I didn't do that. I want to just toy with people's heads and say, you got to read the book if you want to find out about the front porch.
That's great. I appreciate that.
Okay. All right. Mishna Wolf, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We're out of time. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.